Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
Good morning. We're just reshuffling around here as my co-host Brandon Hoy joins us in the room.
Yes, hello.
Hello, hey, Brandon.
I missed you too. It's been
too.
A while.
It has been. You were
Did I miss last week?
I think your parents were visiting from Napa. I saw your kids were here at Roberta's.
Yeah.
Running around.
Yeah, your daughter was on.
Your daughter?
No, that was the week before.
She was on 2 weeks ago. She was super shy. She barely chimed in. And then last week, she was like, I was on the radio last week with you. And I was like, I know, but you didn't want to be part of it.
She's
like,
What's going on with kids these days?
You know, she just want to be loud and voicing her opinion like her dad.
Yeah, but you should see her on Instagram.
Oh, yeah?
She has her own Instagram account?
No, come on.
Well, when is that appropriate?
I don't know. Is it ever appropriate?
Well, if she's born a photographer, sure.
Oh, I guess that's
or
a good
born
point.
A model, and then she's like the child.
Are you born a model?
You should still censored. No, I think your parents push you into modeling. Unless you're just so
bad. I am a really good stage mom. You should see me.
So today is Thursday, July 25th. This is the Main Course OG. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here with my co-host, Brandon Hoy, who you've already heard from, and Patrick Martins.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. We also have Eric Koss of the Alameda Sun on the line. Good morning, Eric.
Hey there, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking a break delivering newspapers to be on the show again.
Always a pleasure.
Right. Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you. And our guest for the Weekly Grill, we have a full house today. We have Ben Flanner of the Brooklyn Grange, a longtime friend of Heritage Foods and Heritage Radio.
Hello.
Good morning. And
we Real pioneer, Ben Flanner.
I know. We're going to talk a little bit more about
that. He has more acres on roofs as farms than anyone else in the world.
I read it's 80,000? 90,000? Am I way off?
A little bit more than that. We're up to about 4 acres of growing space, which is about 160.
That's awesome. That's over three different rooftops in Long Island City and Brooklyn.
Yep.
With maybe more on the way. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're going to get an inside scoop.
It's actually three farms then. The way the USDA would see that is that's three bona fide farms.
Yeah, three farms.
Not gardens, farms.
One business, yeah. So so there's three different locations that we're producing.
Fantastic. We also have Meg Dow and Drew Nemitz of Yenicott Oysters, located out on the North Fork of Long Island. I think you guys are based in Southold and you farm in the Peconic Bay?
Yes.
Awesome.
Oh, actually, Shelter Island Sound.
Shelter Island Sound. Awesome. Good morning, guys. Thanks for being with us. You were having late night deliveries last night or early morning deliveries today?
Late night. We were on the boat all day, and then we drove in and distributed.
Everybody's well sunned in this room. Yeah. Rooftop farming, oyster harvesting.
I look like powder.
We're just inside in a warehouse in Bushwick. Brandon was
trying to recommend that I close the gate all the time. He's like, you want to avoid the public? Just close your gate all the time. I would look even more like powder. I would go out for a second and get skin cancer.
Can you look more like powder? Also, please, let us see your belly. No. It's got to be the whitest thing ever. I can only imagine.
Brandon has the best summer tan. He takes all of his phone calls on his headphones on his iPhone, and he walks
around
the block.
Bushwick. It's true.
When you work 2 days
but
a week.
But I also live in Mattituck for most of the time as well, so I'm also... You know, at the beach.
I know. We thought we would bring together Long Island farming.
Long Island
local.
In the house.
Long Island in the house. That's right.
Yeah. No foe.
Well, you need your sampler on that one. Ding, ding, ding. All right. We are going to jump into our segment, The Weekly Based. First up is our round robin question. Describe the terroir that you rely on for the success of your business.
This is our first of a series of questions like The View.
Joy Behar, would you like to start?
I'm Joy Behar.
By the way, guys, I saw Joy Behar out in the Hamptons a couple weeks ago, and I was stealthily sending Patrick photos, and I was like,
"His doppelganger."
I was like, "Your doppelganger's here." Yeah.
She looks good.
So do you.
Thank you. She. I'll say our Heritage Foods USA relies on the Flint Hills of Kansas, which is one of the richest soil deposits in all the world, and actually, it's a real place where perennial grasses grow naturally from the earth, and. Free-ranging livestock loves to eat that stuff. It's got some soil, volcanic history and all that, but the soil in eastern, western Kansas, northern Oklahoma, is like why Heritage Foods exists. It's off that terroir powered the heirloom of meat in the U.S. So that's our start.
Meg, what's your terroir?
Our terroir, I think, is we have a really heavy-duty oceanic flow, and what's happening... It's funny because what's happening above the surface of the water, also the oysters share that. So it's like our oysters are really sea forward. There's a lot of wave action. Drew has experienced some pretty hectic moments out there the first day on the boat. I think we had 35 mile an hour winds and driving sleet, and he came back.
Wow.
So our oysters are really sea forward. And it takes on the environment, and it's pretty remarkable how, like, being on the boat and working every day, the oysters just totally capture that essence of the sea.
You taste it in the Peconic and in the Shelter Island Sound. When you're swimming in it,
yes,
you can
it's just like there's
a flavor.
It's a bite.
Yes,
it's a sea bite.
It's different than most, bays or even, like, sounds. Yeah. It just really
I really
has
can't hear anything
kind of
over this music. I'm sorry to interrupt the...
All right, don't worry. Jeep cut it for you, Eric. We cut the fast-paced
usually
music.
That's for the round robin, but... So what's your terroir, Ben?
My terroir is a whole blend of organic matter and compost, and the cycle that's happening with that, combined with all the minerals in our soil. And I guess that's composed of lots of different food scraps that people bring up to the roof, chocolate husk that we collect from some local chocolate companies, all of the decaying plant matter from our existing and crop cycles, and how everything combines with the microorganisms in this cycle that just keeps the nitrogen and potassium and phosphorus coming and available to the plants.
It's Are your vegetables in hoop houses, or is everything exposed to New York City air?
They're a combination of both, but mostly exposed. Mostly green roofs, which are open
So does that
spaces.
Terroir, as Patrick would say, have a little
he
extra
created it.
Taste?
He created little, his own yeah. terroir. That's really interesting, and yet it's still agriculture. It's not in a thing. You know, that's wild.
Every once in a while, our pH gets a little high, and a little known fact that acid rain can actually bring down the pH. We don't really get much, but every once in a while, we hope for just a little bit lower acidity in the rain.
Very interesting. All right, so first question of the weekly base, where we go around, The View style. Barbara Walters? Let's talk delicacies. Four businesses, in the room sell niche delicacy products, you know, comparatively delicacy, like versus like a McDonald's hamburger. Vegetables, herbs, oysters, Blanca, you know, tasting menus, the best pizza, heritage breed meats. Describe the state of the delicacy movement to you.
True, go for it.
Right now, I think most people are going towards smaller oysters. Like many, many years ago, everyone used to be into much larger oysters, and now they're going more cocktail size.
Is that something you can plan for somewhere like in the Shelter Island Sound in the Peconic Bay? Like, do you get to select your oyster size or change things to make them a different size, or are you just there's one type of oyster coming out of the Peconic?
A lot of it is the size that the customer or client wants.
So you'll pull them earlier?
Yes.
And is there more flavor in a smaller oyster?
A little bit more action packed.
And I'm assuming people pay more for them to be pulled earlier.
Really depends on what you want to charge.
It's like a suckling pig. We charge more if you ask us to kill the pig early.
Well, that's what I thought. Yeah, the smaller, exactly. are they more, I don't know, is it more rarefied? Is
what
that
would
harder
someone
to come
pay
by?
For an oyster? At a restaurant, $2.75, $3 an oyster?
$3.50.
Okay. So it's a delicacy. I mean, is demand pushing you guys to grow because more people want to spend, you know, whatever, $27 on an oyster plate?
I think the demand is growing. I think more people are eating oysters now. We also can control its growth rate. So different methods of farming, sometimes we want to control if they stay smaller, they grow slower. So they'll be more compact and more appealing to a lot of people.
You know, I got a really interesting oyster story for you guys if you want to hear it.
Yeah.
You know, you must be familiar with the author Jack London.
Sure.
Call of the Wild and all that stuff. He actually lived here in the city of Alameda for a little bit. And one of the things that he did was he actually made money as an oyster pirate, where there were people who were farming oysters legitimately. This is back in, like, you know, the 1800s or something like that. And the oysters are just naturally here on the shoreline of this part of the bay. And so it was a very lucrative market. People would kind of, like, fence off their little oyster farms. And Jack London and his buddies would come along in the middle of the night and just kind of, like, steal all the oysters and take them to market. And it's kind of funny that later on, when his boat burned and he had all this trouble, he decided to go the other way, and he became a game warden who was actually busting oyster pirates. So he was on both sides of the law.
He was a scumbag. He was a snitch. He was, I mean, you get the death penalty in Long Island for doing that. That's why they got Drew there, the muscle. He goes and he chases people
down.
Do people
steal?
He turned snitch.
It is interesting, this idea. Well, we have Christopher Nicholson, the salmon. You know, the salmon run across a very thin line through the river, and your boat, you just have the size of your boat is the only thing. So sometimes all the salmon are two boats over.
Yeah.
So, of course, you're, you know, pushing aside. They're like, hey, you're in my space. But, you know, all that money, they're getting zero. The other family's getting rich. It's weird.
You know what really stinks is having an 8-year-old agave stolen from you out of your field.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Tequila and mezcal world, they grow those agaves for like 8 years, and they weigh like 200 pounds, and someone can sneak up with a truck and grab one, and just lost years of work.
Huh.
So anyway, tell us about delicacies. I mean, are more and more people wanting to spend a lot more than they need to, unless they cared about health and all that?
One of the things that we're always sort of dealing with that challenge of the small versus the large vegetables, and just like with meat, you know, or with animals, the growth happens at this later stage. So we really try to steer away from the super small vegetables because it's just not that efficient use of your time and the.
But
and
you
the
do microgreens.
We do microgreens. That's a little different growing operation. That's in our greenhouses. But one thing I was going to say about trends that we've noticed a little bit lately is that the at the farmers markets, the customers still are really interested in the salad mixes. But the salad mix demand has slowed down a little bit at the restaurant level, and it's getting replaced a little bit more with like little gems and other more crunchy vegetables. So that's something that we've made some adjustments to our growing.
Interesting. Crunchy vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Crunchy.
It's funny because a lot of people don't offer those small vegetables. So like what we did here on the roof was the things that Carlo or any of the other chefs wanted to be small that we couldn't get, that's what we started specializing in. So instead of trying to grow the stuff that Ben is such an expert at growing, why do that when you can, there's a great chain of local suppliers to get that kind of stuff. What we started doing was growing the things that we couldn't get. So it's like if we couldn't get the sizes or like edible flowers, which are just ridiculously expensive for God knows what reason, because they're almost, they're really easy to grow, but they're really, really, they're really, really expensive. So, but when it comes to those things, like those are delicacies. Like, so we took those into our own hands. They're things that we could do here that add just a little bit of character to a dish that are either hard to get or extremely expensive. So I think Brandon says it still exists here,
he's talking about the roof at Roberta's. Yes. Actually, the roof of the radio station directly right above us has a garden.
But this was the first place that Ben put soil on a roof. So this was the first Brooklyn Grange, baby. We're number one.
No, that's not true. Cool. Eagle Street was the first place because while we were doing this, he had already done.
You mean in Long Island City?
No. In Greenpoint, which was the very first, we're number two.
I love being number two.
And you guys have had Annie on before on many shows in here, and Annie and Ben were partners over there, and that was the real beginning of the pioneer movement of the whole thing. Really,
2010. I read the Brooklyn Grange website. A bunch of ragtag group of people met in Long Island City with hard hats and shovels, and they went up to the roof, and there was thousands of pounds of soil.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and what Brandon's talking about was actually 2009.
All right. So the original. So speaking of farmers markets and, you know, who's buying from you, I want to talk about the state of mom and pop businesses. What is the state of those businesses in each of your neighborhoods, whatever you consider your neighborhood to be? The North Fork, Navy Yard, Long Island City. What's left?
Well, I can speak about Alameda real fast. Yeah. I mean, our small business community here in town is really strong. I think it's actually a big reason why my little local newspaper still survives is, I mean, we have two separate downtowns in this town, and each of them is a thriving small business community. And then the other thing that's happened out here, you know, we kind of legalized that thing, that drug called marijuana, and that actually spurred a whole bunch of small businesses as well in all kinds of the different niches. For that industry. So it's going strong out here.
I mean, I think they're suffering, but they are these amazing spots like Northern California and New York that keeps them going. I mean, where our farmers raise the best food in the world, you go around and they're actually eating the most terrible food available to them. There's not as much farmers market, so we're blessed. But, I mean, there should be a move towards mom and pops, like boycott of Amazon or Mom and Pop Day. I mean, Amex has one of those days, but in the big picture, mom and pop joints are suffering.
The economical landscape this day and age makes it much more difficult for the mom and pop to survive, though. It's very difficult to own and operate a small business with, especially in New York, where you have increasingly high occupancy rates, rents are high, labor is expensive, costs of goods are expensive. Now you don't necessarily have that all over the country, but in urban areas it's starting to become very, very difficult for a person to operate a small business, a mom and pop business, because your overhead costs are just so expensive.
Well, Anne says if you're not David Chang or Jean Georges, you know, you're probably not opening five restaurants in the next 5 years, you know.
What about the state of like farmers markets and having a stand, you know, in a farmers market or a CSA site pickup? You know, is that
Very costly? Interesting. So I totally agree. I think the pressure to get big and the pressure to scale is becoming ever stronger and stronger with all those constraints and challenges that Brandon was talking about. And I think farmers feel it too. One thing in the vegetable industry particularly is since we started this 9 years ago or 10 years ago, the price of food inflation has been very, very small to zero. Meanwhile, every single other cost has gone up. So that kind of, we're diversified too. We are in other revenue streams too that have fared a little bit better, but just as an example, which is a pressure facing all the farmers. And then to the markets, they're seeing some changes as well too, because there's new technologies. And every time when I'm at a farmer's market on Sunday, I look and see all the experiences people are having, and all the dogs and the kids and strollers walking around and everything. But then thinking, oh, but what if somebody went to the beach? And then they have the right to get this food, but we're only open on Sunday. So then what are they going to do all week? And I think it's interesting to see how there's other options opening up, but not all of them staying true to form, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So in the North Fork, I think it's kind of like an incubator space. There's a lot of micro businesses, a lot of women starting very small, very specific things in agriculture, fishing, vineyards, and some spirit producers. There's a lot of support in the community, and a lot of people help each other get started, maybe share employees, share equipment, share space. There's a lot of non-for-profits out there that do give help, assistance, funding, and there's some government grants for ag out there, which are really helpful, and it's giving people the opportunity to really start these small, really cool, very like unique
the businesses. North Fork is an anomaly though.
Like
they're also very anti the corporate push.
They are.
So they're also the bureaucracy that exists past Riverhead like doesn't really allow this kind of like corporate takeover.
Well, what about
the push against Airbnb, the push against Uber, the push against all of these like technology changes that are kind of like, you know, taking over these big corporate pushes. Like the North Fork isn't really allowed.
What about Florida Keys is the same way? I'm wondering if when you're on an island, you know, like that, or isthmus or peninsula, whatever it is, and you have so much access to fish and right there that they can afford to be there. I wonder if like fast food and big companies do worse in like beachfront.
But think about it. But you can answer that question yourself because you spend time out on the Keys. Like there, it's all mom and pop, Robbie's.
Only.
Like all the hotels are like owned, but like they're not
one
like Hilton's.
Starbucks on the whole. Strip.
Yeah, the whole place is mom
one
and
Burger
pop.
Burger King.
Mm-hmm. So Long Island is one of the most expensive farmlands per acre in the country. But they were all potato farms, potato, cauliflower, and then in the 80s they became vineyards. But now, as the next generation is coming over, a lot of these farms are kind of coming up for sale, and there's a few organizations that help young farmers purchase them and start these little micro farms, and some of them have residences on them, so it makes it viable.
What about the Long Island duck? Whatever happened to that?
It keeps moving around.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
You still raise ducks out there? That's cool.
They do.
That was a household name.
Crescent Duck in Aquabog, they're still running, and they make an excellent product.
Hopefully they use heritage breeds. That's cool.
When I was on the North Fork the last time, a lot of the local vineyards were offering, small, minimal, but still a discount to local residents. And this idea that I think you can buy things online, you could probably buy local wines online and have them delivered, even though you could drive down the street and go buy it yourself. And so it said at the bottom of the menu of one of the vineyards I was at, that if you showed your local, but you really had to be within the county.
Yeah.
If you showed your local ID, you could get, it was like 5 or 10% off. And staying local, supporting local, understanding that big box companies, larger corporations can give you a discount, but that's not what it's about. It's about supporting the people down the street.
So, what about this navigating local deliveries in New York?
I mean, so you guys were delivering last night, and
it's the most challenging place to make deliveries in the country,
so
without
tough.
A doubt. So, but there's also sales components to it. There's meeting the chefs while you're making the delivery. So, discuss that reality for both you guys, including Roberta's with their pizzas.
Parking tickets.
It's built into your cost of doing business, I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
Well, we haven't really built that in. I spent my 20s in New York driving box trucks around doing events. So, I have some driving skills. I just drive around with my truck with my two dogs. They're my security. And
what kind of dogs?
I have a Boston Terrier named Iggy and a Jindo from Korea named Nanook. And it's pretty
How often simple. Are you in the city delivering?
I usually drive in once a week. Either he takes them in or I drive in. Occasionally we have someone else, but Drew probably has some stories about toting coolers around.
That's the law of averages. When you deliver 7 days a week, you will get parking tickets. There's no denying it. If I only had to do it one day a week, I could probably avoid parking tickets at all costs. But when you deliver in a box truck and a van 7 days a week, the inevitability of tickets are
Drew, you got any tricks of the trade for the listeners, for Patrick?
It's got to be quick on your feet. I've had the chance to deliver for both Yenica and Heritage, so it's kind of circling the block a few times and waiting for that spot.
Were nice in Heritage. That was a Mercedes you were driving.
Sedan. I'll find a movie set and I'll go to the crew and I'll say, hey, can I just park next to you guys for a few minutes and give them a smile? And that helps a lot.
You don't give them a couple oysters. You shuck them on the spot.
They
and
don't know what I'm doing. They're just like, who's this crazy lady with coolers?
Oh my God.
By the way, FYI, I made deliveries for Heritage Foods for a year and a half.
I know.
In a U-Haul, an unrefrigerated U-Haul, even in
the summer.
I wasn't
really going to promote that on the air.
Well, yeah, that's a weird thing to bring out.
I was downplaying that for sure.
Statute of limitations. That was 2004.
Ben, what about you? How does Brooklyn Grange products get delivered?
Well, we deliver twice a week, wholesale and refrigerated vehicles, and yeah, it's a challenge.
He's like, let me note, my stuff is refrigerated.
Do you ever go?
Yeah. Especially if somebody calls out sick or something, or if we're in a pinch. Not so often these days, though. But I love making deliveries once a year.
You have full time drivers.
He used to be the dude. He did it for a very long time. You always could count on seeing Ben like on your delivery with your lettuces.
That's nice.
But delivery is definitely an underappreciated concept, and I do wish that the 8 million people of New York could experience it once or twice. Like the concept of going down these tiny little slippery stairs, down these tiny hatches, sometimes carrying like 50, 60 pounds with you, and bumping into corners and scraping your wrists against the sides and stuff.
Look around you and anything in your life and name something that has not been on a truck.
Yeah.
Everything has, even your bottle of water. And, you know, that even trees, couches, TVs, everything. And so those are national truckers that really are like the unofficial policemen. They stop, they help people on the highways. And then it goes to these local guys who are like ballerinas, dancers, dancing through this jungle, you know, of stuff. And it's just amazing, you know, that everything operates off those people.
Okay, so besides delivery trucks, what tools do each of you rely on for your trade?
I'd say good weather.
That's a good tool. Although Meg said that your first day there was sleet.
Yeah, it was pretty hairy, and we had this like 45-minute window to get out there and do everything, and it was pretty like white knuckle. It was scary.
He won my heart over that day. I was like, this dude is the best.
He's a keeper.
He is a keeper.
When I saw Drew a couple weeks ago, I think your other tools are zinc. Zinc oxide covering your body. Oxide, yep. He's just one color going out there.
I look like Big Bird.
It's the power.
A little fisherman's kind of hat covering you on all sides.
Yep.
And then what else?
I would say I'm totally connected to my boat. Like, it's become like part of me. It's like the weirdest thing. I didn't expect that.
There's a book called Hemingway and His Boat, which I read like the first 100 pages of because it was down in the Keys. But he and his boat, like they were married. That was the only relationship he really never.
What about his cats?
And his cats. I don't know. He couldn't have known them all by name. To this day, they're all there. There's thousands of cats in his museum. If you don't like cats, you can't go to Southern.
They're stuffed. Tip.
You just can't go.
Oh, they're alive.
They live, yeah. Oh. And they're four-toed cats. Six toes. Yeah, they're all with a weird number of toes.
They're all inbred. They're all inbred.
No, they were bred for a certain thing. Yeah, they probably are inbred too.
I'm gonna go with they were inbred.
What about a shucker? Do you have a famous shucker that you always use, like an antique shucking device?
Yeah, Meg, your family's been in the oyster business for what, over 100 years?
Yeah.
So is there one shucker passed down?
No, there wasn't. I found some antique shuckers. Honestly, we actually shuck oysters on the boat with a screwdriver.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd say that.
Because we can never find the knife.
Use screwdrivers. Their tagline is, they're the asbestos. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right.
Sorry. They rinse it in the bay first.
Shuck the rust away.
Yeah, that's good. Ben, how about you? One handy tool.
We're tool junkies. We use tons of tools.
So what's on your tool belt?
I think our favorite, probably our most valuable tool right now is our greens harvester. It hooks up to a cordless drill, and it has a rotating serrated blade that's about 20 inches wide, and these little cool tassels that flip over the top, and then they kick the greens into this back bin, and it increases the harvesting speed by probably about 10 times what it used to be without that.
I love Ben so much. Can I say that officially? Sure. On air? I love it. He's an inventor. He's, you know, a pioneer. It's so cool to build your own tools because you must have such specific needs.
That one was purchased.
But you've also probably invented things to accommodate your
tweaking things and fixing things. Yeah, definitely.
So I want to talk about seasonality. Have Americans lost their connection to it? Have people also lost their respect for it? Nor there certain.
Maybe we should ask Eric this question. He lives in a place where there is no seasons.
How does it feel?
Would you like to hear his answer?
In a place that did have seasons. I grew up in New Jersey. I actually have a sense of what I lost. And the fact of the matter is, it's really hard to be seasonal when it's kind of like sunny outside and there's Christmas trees in the stores. It's kind of odd, but. We still try to pretend that, you know, the seasons happen, but you guys have it a lot better because you actually have, evidence of it happening right in front of you outside your houses or whatever.
Well, that's not good for business, though, is it, Ben? To be closed for 6 months?
It's a really interesting question because that's the way all of the technology, like the high-tech growing in agriculture is going. It's still really only... leaves of lettuces, but it's happening in indoors where they control the environment and they're actually manufacturing their own light. I think people are becoming a lot less connected with seasonality in their lives from food and other things.
So before the show, we were talking about, Patrick, can you tell me the knuckle thing that you can count on your... what was it for
31 days.
The months.
The top of the knuckle is the top of the knuckle is 31 days. The bottom is 30 or 28.
Okay.
And then August, July and August are twice on the pinky.
Okay. And then yesterday you were telling me there's something about the knuckles about when like soft shell crabs are in
season.
That's
not knuckles, although the
ones have ours?
Ours, yeah. Months right, with so, R's, you're not
so
supposed
is there something with the knuckles for when oysters are in season?
No, or R's, the months with R's. Are you not supposed to eat oysters? Is that old wise tale true?
It is now, the way we're farming. I personally prefer oysters from, like, October to the end of November.
Why?
Where we are, our oysters become a lot sweeter because they're building up sugars to survive through the wintertime. So to me, I think they're delicious then. In the summer, they're way saltier, and a lot of people like that fresh oceanic flavor. But
how old is an oyster, just real quick, before when I eat it, like at Roberta's, when would that life cycle begin? Like 2 years earlier, 1 year earlier?
It depends on the location. We're growing oysters 12 to 18 months because we are in such a heavy flow of water, and our oysters are growing a lot faster than some others. In Maine, it takes about 3 years. So in Florida, it takes 8 months.
Last stupid question. Are there anything like the equivalent of a starter in bread or vines for wine, something that carries over for the full 100 years with your oyster program, or is it just the water itself?
And like, are there original genetics? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, or something old?
No, we don't have like any heirloom oysters, but we do buy seed from hatcheries, and they breed them specifically for disease resistance. There's a genetic marker on farm-raised oysters. It has a black line on the flat side of the shell, and that's an indication of an oyster that has, you know, disease-resistant qualities.
Hmm. Do you always have to go to the hatchery to populate the next year's supply?
We do that, but Drew and I are going to do some spat collection next year and have a special oyster that we're hopefully putting on the market that's a wild spawn, because we also have a nursery Where we, a lot of oyster farmers buy their seed at half inch or a little bigger, but we actually buy them at 2 millimeter. We have a nursery and we grow them from 2 millimeter. So it's kind of a little different. We have more control over some of the factors.
The October to November oyster, is it also more firm? They seem to be like a little bit firmer, yeah. Oyster. They're sweet and firm, which yeah. I usually like as well. I like those like cold water, yeah. Like when the water starts getting cold.
They're building up their stores for the winter, just like a beehive does. I mean, they get beefier. They can carry through because they don't feed when the water goes under a certain temperature because there's no plankton or algae there.
Makes sense.
Pretty cool. So I want to briefly talk wine. Yesterday, Patrick and I were sitting with Sam Ben-Ruby. He's host of HRN's The Grape Nation. And since Yenicott Oysters was coming in, and I asked him what we should be drinking this morning and while we're talking about oysters. So he said that the obvious classic pairing is champagne, but that he personally likes Muscadet. It's a dry, saline, crisp white wine, and that it's a better value than champagne. He also said we couldn't go wrong with rosé from Provence because they're dry. So that's what we've been drinking this morning here in the studio. What's your go-to drink, either in your line of work or in life? You said something about an oyster luge earlier, Meg.
Yes.
Is that your go-to?
Well,
tell us what an oyster luge is.
An oyster luge is after you eat an oyster, you pour a spirit in the shell and drink it out of the shell with some of the seawater that's left over, the oyster liquor, and it's kind of a fun thing to do. And certain areas of the world, where the oysters are grown and where those spirits are grown, they kind of connect with each other. I learned about it through my friend who's a cocktail writer, and she was doing an article on scotches in Scotland, and she ate oysters right outside the distillery where all the peat was running off, and she did an oyster luge, and that's how I found out about it. So we were trying all local spirits on the North Fork, and the best one we found was, which isn't local, but Bar Hill honey-based vodka. Hmm. Out of the oyster shell.
So that would be your preferred spirit for the oyster luge.
For our oysters, because we did a lot of testing.
Good.
That sounds awesome.
That sounds really good. Well, you know, it's funny what you said, that this kind of connects, and this is my answer to the delicacy question. Delicacies, I think, are meant to be done in huge amounts, but only once a year, once every 2 years. But when you do them, you gotta do them, and you gotta do that with the thing. And I think that Americans misunderstand it, and delicacies are supposed to be done very little. But it's not true. When you do them, you do it a lot. So you shouldn't only order 6 oysters. You should order 55, order 80 oysters. Try them all, but then you don't do that again. And you spend a lot of money that day, but the other days you're responsible.
I have to be honest, rarely do I agree with you. You're almost so full of shit almost all of the time.
But
on this one,
but
I agree. When it comes to oysters, I'm also a feast or famine.
Yeah.
I think
caviar.
I like oysters in a large amount. Like when I go to, even by myself, I will get like 20 oysters.
Tag that I said that. That was
and,
a good
and you guys know this place, and there's a very little creek in Greenport. It's nice because it's like they offer a lot. Mm-hmm. You can get a lot, and not just local oysters. You can also get West Coast oysters or oysters from Maine, and it's nice. It's nice to like sit in contrast and see what locally they're producing and how it holds up against something from Washington or something from Maine. It's nice.
Your cheese
I like
plate.
To do it.
You're experiencing
I oftentimes
things
feel a sense of pride when the 9 out of 10 the Long Island ones are better than the West Coast ones.
And even drinking, we should be drinking a lot. Like, we should come crawling into our building elevator.
10:40 in the morning.
Once
not
a year.
For a month.
No, but then
once a year.
You have to let yourself go. People never let themselves go, ever. And that's wrong. You're supposed to have some very high highs and, you know, the next morning followed by lows. Sorry, Ben, what were you going to say?
I have an oyster question. I was wondering how everybody feels about mignonettes.
I like it.
And all the fixins, because sometimes I'm a little concerned that it's masking the true flavor of the oyster and you're just drinking vinegar.
So along
or
with
lemon
the
lemon juice, if you were.
That's a good question.
Before our Yenicott friends answer, I'm with Brandon on, like, you have to have a lot because you want to try them different ways. You want to have it pure.
Yeah.
You want to have it with mignonette. Maybe you, maybe you're a cocktail sauce person, although for me that totally masks the oyster. Maybe you want to have a little luge.
I'm with you. I'm a process person. I would say my first round is always just raw.
Pure.
Like, I just want them. Yep. Then I may start dabbling in lemon, right? And it's like, if I'm eating 100 oysters, like, I start getting into the hot sauce. Like, eventually you just start going. And usually this is paired with some drinking. And I would say probably the more I drink, the more I'm willing to put something on my oyster.
What
but
you,
in the beginning,
what
I'm
do you
almost
drinking
always
with your
raw.
Oysters?
I mean, most of the time I'm drinking beer.
Okay. What is it, the Miller Life, the champagne of beers?
No. I mean, usually it's something out. Usually
King.
It's, no, actually, it's funny because out there it's not. It's like I'm usually probably
Montauk.
Drinking, yeah, like a Northeast IPA or something from Greenport Brewery or something out there because that's what everybody carries. But
if I'm given oysters and I don't have the luxury of eating 100 and I'm not the one paying the bill, or, you know, I've tried, I've lobbied for more oysters, but I got rejected by the table, I will ask for horseradish because that I do like. It's not instead of the oyster.
Holy Schmidt.
So wait, let's hear the mignonette. Let's hear the accoutrement answer.
So, I don't know. I like to try all different things, and I've been experimenting with crazy stuff. I do like to try them first and then, you know, build upon and just try. But I did make a local horseradish tequila bitters and with tomato juice and put it on there. And that, I think that's like something I'm going to keep.
That's the 2019 win.
That's the that's in the cupboard, and that's going to stay on at our house forever.
It's good.
But
will you ever package it, market it?
I mean, that sounds delicious. I want some.
I know.
Also, maybe just the recipe.
Yeah,
would
I could
be
give
cool.
you the recipe.
Yeah.
I think I'd like to just share it when, you know, oysters are a celebratory food. And, like, usually you do it because, like, you want to feel better. You're with friends. You're celebrating. Or you're just celebrating, like, a moment to just chill out. So I definitely will share with that recipe. Okay. I don't want to market it at all.
I just like to do it, like, simple, easy, a little bit of lemon, and drink of choice would probably be like a year-round rosé. It's kind of whenever.
I'm in.
Yeah, you're a pink guy. You're a pink guy all the time. We see it.
He eats them for breakfast.
Yeah, of course he does. Where are you guys delivering? Like, where can we find your oysters? Who are the big buyers?
Roberta's
for you guys?
Is Roberta's one?
Not yet.
We actually don't sell a lot of oysters. We did at one point when we had the raw bar in the back.
Yeah, I remember
but
I
since
love that
then,
idea.
We're not. We don't. We actually don't sell. It's. I would say logistically, it's a very hard thing to do.
Have you ever
for
done
us.
A clam pizza?
Yeah, yeah. We sell a clam pizza. Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
I mean, Brandon, maybe you need to be the oyster shucker out back and
in the hot tub.
I oyster shucked for a long time, and I fucking hate it. Oh. It is not some, like, I'm not one of the people that are like, yeah, just give me the bag of oysters and I'll start shucking them myself. After about six, I'm just like, fuck this. Somebody else do it for me. I just want to drink. Your hands are all cold, and, you know, I'm like, never get it fully clean, where there's always like one little shell in there that drives me nuts.
Well, as we have you guys thinking about that, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with a little more with Ben Flanner, Meg Dow, and Drew Nemitz. Stick around.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Korsha Wilson, and I'm the host of A Hungry Society here on HRN. A Hungry Society focuses on highlighting dope people doing amazing work in food, and we talk about how we can make the culinary world a more diverse and inclusive space. You can join the conversation by checking out Hungry Society wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, welcome back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We were just having a little bit of an off-the-air conversation. If you were with us before the break, we're with Meg Dow and Drew Nemitz of Yenicott Oysters, located out on the North Fork of Long Island, and Ben Flanner of the Brooklyn Grange, with three farms here in Brooklyn and Long Island City.
Off-the-air, we were trying to figure out vertical stripes or horizontal stripes. If you're going to wear a onesie, do you always go vertical or do you go horizontal?
Aren't the pants supposed to be different than the shirt?
So they're referring to my outfit today. I'm in a rare occasion wearing a matching top and bottom.
You look like you're in three dimensions.
And aren't humans always supposed to be in three dimensions?
I don't know.
Well, your hat is bugging me out.
Your Blanca hat's a little trippy over there. Today I'm wearing vertical stripes. This is my only suit, if you will, that I own. But thank you guys.
Stripes are more slimming.
This has become
vertical stripes are more slimming, yeah, according to Eric Koss. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Eric.
This has become very insular. Plus, no one can see us.
This is coming from a man who does radio naked.
That would be Eric Koss in Alameda, and a man who does radio only in a Yankees shirt, yep, Patrick Martins.
I don't tell them.
So we were talking before the break about where to find everyone's products. So Yenicott Oysters, where can our listeners find your oysters?
Okay, so we move around a bit, but we're usually always at Zadie's Oyster Room in the East Village. We're at Five Leaves in Greenpoint. We're at the Bedford. We also are at Bar Sardine in the West Village. We had been at Simon and the Whale for a bit. We're at Little Creek in Greenport in the wintertime because I'm their winter gal. And then we are expanding this year, and we will be looking for restaurants that are, you know, fun and kind of pair with what we do and keeping small farms. And
what about at-home shuckers? Do you guys have a green market or a farmer's market where people come by?
We have done some pop-ups in Greenport. I have done the Greenport Farmer's Market. We'll be back there probably at the end of the summer. And we do pop-ups, but right now we're not sure exactly where. We might do one in Rockaways.
We've committed to Drew to open three accounts, but which you can vet and make sure that they're the right for it. But we're going to be like, dude, just so we can selfishly go there and eat.
Thank you. Do you guys have any, do you sell to any fish markets where you can buy at retail?
So we get ice from Southhold Fish Market, so we do a little trade-off. I give him oysters. He gives it. Well, we do exchange money, but we do that. And I really am picking and choosing who I sell to because I really want to keep it small, and I really want to find restaurants and chefs that I enjoy working with. That's really important to me.
No markets.
Just.
What did you ask, Ben? No markets.
I was just asking if you have interest in a stand or something.
I would. It is a lot of work to come in and do green markets. But I think in the future, if I can have assistance and people to help me, I can do that.
Ben, how about you? Brooklyn Grange?
Wait one second. Drew can do just about anything. Oh. I mean, no. Drew worked for us for years, and for Patrick, he can do anything.
You just gotta
keep him busy. Just give him a job. He'll do it.
The question is, does Drew want to give you 7 days, 24 hours a day? Is your wife okay with that? Are you up for sleeping?
I'll sleep, you know. I'll
find some time to sleep, but I do enjoy working.
I always say never trust fishmongers, but I'm making an exception. Do you consider yourself a fishmonger or oyster fish? No.
What do you call yourself?
Fishmonger?
Crusties.
Barnacles?
Crusties. I like that.
Where can people buy? So what's in?
We're aquaculturists. We're oyster farmers, shellfish farmers. That's it. Yeah.
Where can we buy Brooklyn Grange? And also, so many people, like Emily's never been. How do people get into? Is it CSA program? Is that the best way?
You can visit Long Island City, right?
Right. You can visit Long Island City every Saturday from 11 to 4. We sell at 4 farmers markets now, or stands. We're at, should I name them all?
Sure, yeah, go for
we're
it.
We're at McGolrick Park on Sundays in Greenpoint, which we've been at since it started about 6 or 7 years ago. We just started like 2 weeks ago, which we're really excited about, in Sunset Park, right at the Sunset Park at 6th Avenue and 44th Street. And then on Saturday, we're open all day at our Long Island City Farm, which you mentioned, and it's a great day to come up, bring the kids, bring the family or friends or whatever, you can hang out for the day. And then we've just launched also another market at our new farm on Sundays, which is in the lobby of the building currently, and it's going to be moving up to the roof soon.
And where's that new building?
That's in Sunset Park at 30th Street and 3rd Avenue. Yeah.
So the Navy Yard is not open for visitors. That is events and like yoga classes, I was reading. You guys do a lot of
partnerships. No, but if you want to get married, they'll definitely take you.
I'll get remarried. Oh, yeah. I'm married.
Are you an officiant?
Yeah. What was the question?
Can you be an officiant?
Did you get legalized? I'm not legal yet, but I could.
I mean, we could sell a package deal on the air. Right. Get married. Ben Flanner will officiate. You'll have the best oysters, the best vegetables. And Heritage Foods will provide the meat.
Patrick will be the wedding singer.
Yeah,
that's exactly.
Time after time, that's the only song I can sing. Now, let me ask: have you ever places that suffer from famine? So not roofs, but just people who need to grow under tough conditions, or where people are suffering. Do you have any knowledge and insight that could help parts of the world like that because of the unusual forced agriculture you've created out of nothing, in a way?
That's a good question. I'm sure we've solved a lot of challenges that are a little bit out of the box where you could probably carry some information over, particularly with dealing with water and dealing with a shallow soil, which is actually very similar because often soils become hardpan once you go about a foot or 2 feet in, which is almost like hitting the base of the roof. I'm sure we've also dealt with a lot of challenges with wind and... I'm sure we could,
erosion. I mean, you have a lot of common problems. Although in a lot of the places where it's famine, it's usually weather related, which they don't really have that problem. So I think where you usually see famine, it's usually the
water.
Water and usually either a lot of sun and heat, right?
Baking heat and water, I think, are probably some of the biggest challenges.
Can you each talk for 1 minute on the bee culture that you guys cultivate?
We know you both have relationships with bees.
Sure, we have a few dozen bees or beehives. We keep some of our own at our farms and some on some other buildings where we have agreements with the landlords. And then we also have a consulting program where we will tend bees on others' roofs and give them the honey and just have a model where we take care of it for them. And we also do lots of beekeeping workshops, lots of education around bees. There's a lot of interest. People sign up for those.
I have bees on Long Island. I have about, it fluctuates because it's very difficult where I am due to pesticide spraying and whatnot, but I have between 5 and 10 hives. I have it within another larger farm, and I started growing things because of the bees. I'm working on developing models for other farms to have and create pollinator corridors within a large farm so that there is habitat for wild pollinators. And I'm just developing and working with different plants and trying to come up with a very kind of hands-off natural space where farms can keep an area for a beekeeper, but also for natural pollinators because they're struggling with food sources and survival and something needs to be done.
I may be wrong, but because it's been so many years ago, but I believe Ben and I met because of bees. I remember one of the first times I hung out with Ben, we had harvested one of our first honey harvests, and we needed a place to extract all of the honey, and we did it at Eagle Street, and it was a fucking mess.
This
was like everybody's first time.
I came to that.
Was this how the bee sting pizza was born?
Greenpoint.
What's that? Was this how the bee sting pizza was born?
It was with John Feldman and Eddie.
No, I came to one of those things, but it was in front of that hardware store on Grand Street or
Crest. Oh yeah, you guys had a hive.
Oh yeah, we had a hive up there too. Yeah, we did that as well. But this time was really classic because we had no idea what we were doing. We had yet to harvest any of the. I mean, this had to have been 10 years ago.
I think
you
just called and said, "Hey, do you have some space for us to do this?" And I said, "Yeah."
I'm pretty sure that's how it worked. And then you had to watch us bumble. Like, we had no idea how to use, like, any of the tools. We were, like, trying to cut the wax off the frame. Like, we had no idea what we were doing at this point. We had all of the frames and the centrifuge. It was our very first time extracting. And we probably had 40 frames.
Was it a hand crank?
It was a hand crank. It was.
I do it that way.
It was. And it was our first experience. And we probably looked like a bunch of idiots. We were probably also drunk and possibly high.
Did you do it in a screen tent? Because if you don't and you're outside, you will have a problem.
No, we were inside. And that was actually, we had read about this. That was actually where Ben came in. We were like, we need somewhere like that we can get dirty.
You guys heard it here. Don't hire Brandon. Only hire the Brooklyn Grange to help consult with your beekeeping needs.
This was many, many years ago. This was our first four. This was over a decade ago. This was our first foray into bees. We obviously, over time, learned. Everybody probably has a story about their first time. It's never the most interesting or easy.
Like my first radish.
For those just tuning in, we were talking about the first time of beekeeping.
Well, let's talk something about first time. We've probably been the show that's had the most 100-year businesses on it. You know, the Edwardses, all those kinds of people. So is it a pressure to continue? I mean, did you be like, no one else has left or no one else wants to do it? I have to keep this 100-year tradition going. It's a lot of baggage.
No, I don't think so.
No?
It just kind of, oddly enough, happened like very organically. By the time I was born, that industry had pretty much collapsed due to overfishing and pollution. Mm-hmm. So I could get into stuff if you have any questions about that and the history about my family.
Well, that's cool. 100-year businesses, there are not so many of them. That was our legacy question. You know, Roberta's, will it be around in the 100
years? But you would
think yes.
The bigger stress, Patrick, you'd have to think the bigger stress is like now you have to have kids to continue this, right? Like who else comes after you? That seems like the nagging mother that's like, did you have kids yet?
Yeah, well, I don't have kids and that ship has sailed.
You bring in good people like Drew and people who want to hold down the fort.
She just pointed at you, Drew, and I was like, they're not supposed to have kids together. They're just supposed to...
Friends or family.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
You know what I mean?
Of course, that's
boys
can
take over businesses, too.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's probably maybe the more appropriate way. You find the people who are most connected to the business and the well-being of
it. So you're going
to
bequeath Roberta's to me?
Are you fucking kidding me?
I've been here doing a radio show for 10 years.
First of all, nobody's bequeathing anything in this room.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. And we have some wonderful smelling dill in the room and lavender that you brought also from your farm out on the North Fork. And
Tuned with us next hour. We're going to be doing a visual demonstration on how to shuck oysters. So turn your radio up. Turn the volume up.
Exactly. No, but really, thanks for listening, guys. Please check out the Brooklyn Grange and Yenicott Oysters. And we will be back next Thursday.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the food world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.